From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in the first month after the pandemic ends. Where are the people going and what are they doing? Where are people moving? What are their priorities? In an op-ed for the New York Times, Allison Arieff writes about the magic of empty streets, saying, quote, urban planners have long argued that more streets should close to make more livable spaces, but governments have always resisted, calling it impractical or impossible. Well, they've just proved it can happen, and they should keep it going after this crisis, end quote. So is that the kind of change coming our way? Will cities be different? Will more of us walk, enjoy the quiet, live differently? Or will it maybe go the other way? Will the pandemic convince more Americans to live in the countryside? Or maybe in suburban settings, or away from the denser cities where the virus has spread quickly. In the past week, there's been a lot of discussion about COVID-19 and population density. New research finds the disease is spreading through rural areas with significant speed as well. But of course, the biggest caseloads are in cities like New York. Will this change the movement towards cities? In recent decades, all around the world, that's been the trend, more people living in cities. Urbanists are a little worried about what that means going forward post-pandemic, and I want to welcome our guests on the line with us for the hour now. David Riley is a planner and senior research associate for the Center for Governmental Research. David, thanks for making time for the program.
Hi, Evan. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Howard Decker, an architect and a board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. Welcome, Howard. Thanks for making time.
Thanks, Evan. It's good to be with you again.
And hello to Dr. Andy Alleen, an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Alleen, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks, Evan, for having me.
Well, thanks to all of you. And so let's start really sort of kind of at the broad lens here, because what I want our listeners to kind of think about this hour are the kinds of questions you may have about how we live, what we're learning about ourselves, sure, and that's exactly what Allison Arieff was writing in the New York Times, what that means for the future, but also where you want to be in the future, and if this pandemic changes any of that calculation for you. I also want you to think about maybe who's more insulated from the kind of pain that we're seeing right now and where they may live and what that means. David Riley, what are the big kind of the big picture questions as a planner, as a senior research associate, as we watch this pandemic unfold here?
Well, I think as we I've seen some of the same pieces that I think you have that make a connection between density and the spread of the coronavirus. And I've been kind of preoccupied with that, I guess, as a planner, because I think it's kind of a one-size-fits-all explanation that glosses over a lot of important details that I hope we really think through on the other side of this about how policy responses to the pandemic have differed across the country in different places, how this spreads in places that we gather in all different kinds of communities, our workplaces, our schools, supermarkets, houses of worship. And I hope it also prompts us to think about how underlying problems with race and economic inequality are driving how this affects different kinds of people. At the same time, along the lines of the column that you were talking about in the opening, I think this maybe brings up some opportunities for us to think about in planning and designing cities to make them more livable for people. Streets, I think what we're seeing really lends some validity to what people have been saying for a long time about trying to create more space for pedestrians and cyclists to be able to move about freely without being crowded. I think we're seeing the value of green space and parks in a way that we probably haven't in any other recent time, about the need for transportation, public transportation systems that are funded such that people aren't kind of packed in cheek by jowl. So I think there are, some worrisome things here, but I think a lot of opportunities for planners and policymakers to think about.
We're going to come back especially, and I think our guests, probably all of our guests will have things to say about race and about who's being impacted in different ways, as David mentioned there briefly. And so we will certainly return to that theme. We'll talk about some of the best case, worst case post-pandemic to kind of come out of this. And maybe just for a moment, Howard Decker, as I kind of ask you for your 30,000-foot view, let me also make a plea to everyone listening. I mean, I live in Shalott in northern Rochester, and there's not a whole lot of people out right now because of the pandemic. And you would think that that would make for more placid streets because there's not nearly as many cars on the streets. Instead, we have this bizarre thing where I'm hearing drag racing at night and people are going ridiculous speeds because they probably think they can. I got behind somebody driving into the station this morning who was going like 20 and a 35. Everybody else was going like 60. Have we all lost our minds on the road, Howard Decker? What's happening here?
Yes, we are. Yes, Evan, we have all lost our minds on the road.
Please, just drive normally, people.
The New York Times had a piece yesterday that said that speeds in New York are up, in New York City are up 288%, which is a suggestion that, you know, many are taking advantage of the fact that there are fewer vehicles on the streets. But I want to back up, and I want to address the question that I think we started with here, which is, are cities inherently more liable to attack by the virus? And statistically, are big cities and dense cities showing themselves to have more cases of the virus than other locales? Because I think the answer to that question starts to reflect on the other questions you've raised about where people might want to live in the future and so on. At any rate, I've looked at six major cities around the world. Many of them, almost all of them, are up around 10 million in population. And most of them have virus incidence between 1 and 3,000. That's compared to New York City, which is a city of about 8.5 million people, which has 104,000 cases. So, when you dig into the statistics, which I'm happy to do if you'd like, when you dig into the statistics, what you find is that it's not about the density of a city. It's not about high rises and skyscrapers and tall buildings. It's about behavior. It's about how we act, what we choose to do in the face of the virus. And when we are assisted by strong, centralized controls being exerted by nations or cities or states, it gets it a little bit easier even for us to do a good job. But there are plenty of very, very large cities in the world that have very, very low incidence of the virus. So the basic answer to your question, is there a relationship between density and the virus and big cities and the virus, is we don't really know everything about this yet statistically, but the basic answer appears to be no.
Well, interesting. I mean, the other cities that you mention around the world, 10 million people, they probably don't have Donald Trump as a president and Bill de Blasio as a mayor. And that's a bad combination for New York City, given everything that's happened, Howard. It's also fair to point out, Howard, that not only is there a pretty wide variation in terms of caseload in cities, but in rural areas, we have seen places like rural Georgia, where journalists have and researchers have tried to track the spread of a lot of cases there per capita because, you know, a small group of people at a funeral, and then the next day we're at a party, and the infection spread very quickly through a rural area. Go ahead.
Let me just try and kind of put this point you're making into a little bit finer focus. Let's, for a moment, focus on Seoul, which is the capital of South Korea. Seoul is a city with 10 million people. As of this morning, Seoul has had 1,337 cases of the virus. 10 million people, 1,337 cases. Now, to put that in perspective, we live in Monroe County. Monroe County has a population of around 750,000, and we, as of this morning, our virus's count is 768. So a city of 10 million has about twice as many virus cases as our county of 750,000. How have they done it? Well, the South Koreans exerted a very early and very powerful and very comprehensive set of controls that have worked. They did massive testing, which, of course, we haven't done. They did massive quarantining, and if you were discovered to have a high fever or a positive result in your test, you weren't told to go home. you were escorted to a state-run quarantine, and then you were given a complete debriefing so that they could find everyone that you've come into contact with for weeks, and then they could track them all down. And, of course, all of these means of trying to control, and that's in addition to business closures and personal space distancing and all the rest of it. But all of these kinds of centrally exerted controls have had a massive effect on cases of the virus, deaths, and struggling and suffering. And we just haven't done it in the United States, and we're paying a gigantic price for it. 25% of all of the cases of the virus in the world are in the U.S., so it's not great.
So briefly, before I turn to Dr. Aline, it sounds like your conclusion is, for anybody who's thinking post-pandemic, you know, I think we're going to rethink moving to a city. I think we're going to rethink a downtown apartment or, you know, being in a dense space because they don't seem as clean. They seem more susceptible to this kind of a thing. The message seems to be that you think that would be sort of flawed thinking, yeah?
It's very flawed thinking, and it isn't supported by fact.
Cities are fine, it sounds like.
Some cities are fine, and some cities aren't fine. If you get behind the curve with this virus, it will bite you, and it will bite you hard. And many American cities are way behind the curve, and so they're struggling. But if control is exerted centrally and at a very early moment, then living in a city is not any more dangerous than living anywhere else when it comes to this virus.
Well, Dr. Aline, you reached out to us to kind of make an important distinction here, which is that when we talk about density, there are different things here. We could talk about sort of population-level density or city-level density, but that could be different than household-level crowding. And why don't you kind of take us through your concerns there?
Exactly. So at a very big picture level, if you're in an airplane and you're looking at New York City, you'd say, wow, that's got lots of people there. It's got very high population density. Population density is thinking about number of people per square mile. On the other hand, crowding is the number of square feet per person. It's a much more human, household, everyday level of looking at things. And usually the way people think about that is the number of people per room. So, and this matters a lot. So it matters for part of what we've just been talking about of cities in general getting a bad rap when, if you look at it, it doesn't have to be bad for these epidemics, and there's tremendous variability between places. But what gets really interesting is looking at the history of like the 1918 pandemic or looking today. If you look within New York City, for example, if you're thinking that the part of New York City that's going to have the most COVID cases, and so that's where we should be sending our scarce resources and everything, is the part of New York City with the highest population density, then you would say, well, that would be Manhattan. And because Manhattan has a population density of around 70,000 people per square mile, whereas the outlying boroughs have much lower population density. So like Queens, which we know is where there are tons and tons of cases and the hospitals are being overwhelmed and all of that. The population density of Queens is only 21,000 people per square mile, so less than a third of Manhattan. So you see the population density doesn't really match up with where you have lots of severe cases of COVID. But what does match up is the crowding. So if you look at a map of the number of people per room and look for where you have neighborhoods with a lot of crowding, that matches up very well with where the COVID disease cases are.
And so, Dr. Aline, given what we know about inequality in this country in terms of economic inequality, people of color more likely to be faced with poverty, to have much tighter living situations and quarters. Given all of those things that we know, generally speaking, I imagine from your perspective and thinking about public health, it's not a surprise that there is a disproportionate number of people of color. From what we have seen in where we can get the data, people of color suffering the disease and the deaths so far. Does that not surprise you?
That is not surprising.
Yeah. David Riley, then let's talk about race then, because you raised it as a planner and senior research associate for the Center for Governmental Research. What are the most important lessons you think that we've got to carry forward from this once we are past the pandemic?
Well, I think in part we need to think about health disparities, which is something that has been on the radar locally, thanks to research done by folks at Common Ground Health and others over the years, that there are really deep differences, even preceding a pandemic like this, among people of different races, and that people who are Black, who are Hispanic, tend to have higher rates than white people, like myself, of chronic health conditions, that we have higher rates of mortality for some people than others, and that we really need to think about ways to try to address those issues, not just in response to coronavirus, but in general. I would hope that coronavirus, prompts us to think a little bit more carefully about it. I think we also have to think about who typically or on average is lucky enough, like me, to be able to work from home during this kind of situation, and who is more likely to be considered an essential worker and to still have to go to work. And people who are working in lower wage jobs, I think, are often still having to go out and show up at work in a way that I don't have to, because my work tends to be at a desk behind a computer and I can do it from just about anywhere. And as far as the crowding issue that the doctor was talking about, I think there's certainly good research indicating that crowding is associated with poverty. And I think it's important to keep in mind that, this isn't sort of a fundamental problem that that can't be addressed. I've been thinking a lot about kind of the roots of urban planning in the U.S., which really came about in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in response in part to big public health concerns and big public health crises. And a lot of that was driven by crowding and tenement housing, lack of sanitation in tenement housing. And while we still have issues with crowding today, particularly among people in poverty, and that's an issue in urban and rural and suburban places, I'd note, we've really made great strides compared to back then in reducing crowding. And I don't think we would expect the conditions that existed then to exist today. And I would hope we would look at some of the problems that we're looking at today as things that can be addressed through policy and planning.
Sure. And Dr. Aline, to David's point about what we have been able to learn from not just what's happening now looking forward, but looking at our past here, I would ask about 1957. Nobody remembers that pandemic, apparently. 1.1 million people died around the world. 1918 is the one that obviously that a lot of people have their minds on. And are your concerns about public health and about crowding and about where that manifests reflected by what we learned in 1918?
Yes, they are. So, we started talking early on about, is it the virus? Is it people's behaviors? Is it the city? And from a public health perspective, it's all of those things. The simplest way of thinking about public health and epidemics is something called the epidemiologic triangle. And the three things in there are the agent, the host, and the environment. So the agent is the infectious agent. So in this case, coronavirus, or in 1918, influenza virus. The host is the person getting infected, and that includes their behaviors and their medical background and all that. But then there's the third part, which is the environment, which is the conditions that they live in. And so crowding is one of those, but it's also a marker, as people have been bringing up, for all the other aspects of poverty and things that can make you sick. And there have been a couple of recent papers about pollution, for example, being a risk factor for getting sick with the coronavirus infection. And so 1918, the terrible flu pandemic that happened then was much, much worse than what's happening now. And so as bad as things are now, you can imagine what it was like out of nowhere for just people to be dying in vast numbers. And the place that had the highest mortality, that was most noticed, was in the U.S. Army. And so I got interested in this as, is there something to learn from that for preventing future pandemics? And did a little research on some work that had been done way back at the time by one of the doctors who was in the camps then. And he was trying to figure out what was the difference between the people who got sick as opposed to those who didn't get sick. What was the difference people who got very sick with pneumonia versus those who didn't? And he looked at all kinds of different things. And so these are all young men drafted into the Army in the same place at the same time with the same weather. And he looked at race, which is something that people are always interested in. He looked at their ages, how long they were in the Army, what kind of food, how many flies were in each barracks, and how many square foot per man they had. And what they found in that study way back in the 1918 pandemic was the one thing that really stood out was the crowding. As you went from low crowding of, 80 square feet per man to very high crowding of about 40 square feet per man, you had the severe flu going up five times. And it's very rare in epidemiology to have anything where there's a five times difference between one condition and the other. And so this really stood out. And overall, people looking at all of the research from 1918 thought, wow, this crowding really seems to matter. And it's not just about, in the case of the 19 influenza, they concluded it wasn't just about that it helped to transmit things, but somehow it seemed to actually be enhancing the virulence of the virus. And so that's why that's part of what was the impetus for reducing crowding in places after that, because people understood crowding has a really big impact on epidemics of pneumonia.
Dr. Aline, before I turn to our other guests, just briefly here, do you know, would I be sort of making a misstep if I was speculating on why the virulence of a virus increases? Because what I don't want to do is spread misinformation. What I have heard is that generally viruses, they may change over time. Obviously, the flu mutates. Most of the time, we don't see viruses get more virulent. But if we had everyone sort of in really tight space, maybe they would, because for a virus to, I mean, viruses have to travel and they have to be able to spread. So the less virulent viruses, the ones that don't cause the infections quite as bad in some people, people will, sort of carry and spread almost asymptomatically or asymptomatically. Whereas if everyone is sort of potentially involved with a fatal infection quickly, but they're packed close together, there isn't as much of a challenge for the virus in spreading. It can do what it does. Now, that is a really big leap. I don't know if that makes sense, and I want to qualify that. What do you know about that?
Well, Evan, that makes perfect sense, but it's unfortunately it's just theory.
Yeah, okay, there you go.
There's an evolutionary biologist named Paul Ewald who proposed that, and he calls it domestication of infectious diseases. So if we can change the conditions so that we make it easy for the virus to keep us healthy, then viruses will be mild. If we make the conditions so that it's easy for the virus to spread, even if it makes us very sick, then the viruses will get more virulent. So just as you described, if you have to walk around to spread the virus, viruses that make people drop dead aren't going to spread as well. But the problem is, you can imagine, it's very hard to study this. You can't take 100,000 people
right.
And inject them with virus and see what happens. So all we can do is observe after the fact when there are epidemics. But people have kept looking for that kind of phenomenon in people and in animals, in chickens, and for example, see if what makes them get highly virulent. Flu versus mm-hmm. not so virulent flu and things like that.
All right, so listeners, we've given you a lot of things to chew on, and in our second half hour, we are going to try to look ahead a little bit, and I'd love to hear from you as we think about the way we plan our societies, the way we plan our cities, the way We have expectations for what life will be like and how to make it equitable and accessible for everybody, and what we're learning about ourselves and our planning capacity, what it means post-pandemic here with our guests. You just heard Dr. Andy Alleen, who's an associate professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital, David Riley, a planner and senior research associate for the Center for Governmental Research, Howard Decker, an architect and board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. And you can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. Should we close all of the parks? We've seen in many places municipal governments taking down basketball hoops and rims, because people, kids, adults, were still congregating in tight spaces. But what about parks? What about trails? There's a debate across the country about what to do about these open public spaces, and we'll talk about it Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Howard Decker, as we look ahead here, as we think about the way we have built and planned our communities, I was thinking of you recently as I saw pictures of deer walking around highways and whatnot, because, you know, for so long we've heard, you know, and maybe understandably so, because inertia is a powerful force, but people saying, you know, look, it's car society now, we're not going to change, it's car society now, we're not going back. And I think if there is one important lesson that is a broad-based lesson that can be applied to climate change and could be applied to a lot of different things, it's that what we've learned in this pandemic is we certainly can do what we choose to prioritize, and we can do it faster than we think. And, you know, certainly we don't want to entail as much pain as we have experienced here economically and more, but it is within our reach if we prioritize it. That's what I would love to see us carry forward from this. What do you think?
Well, it's clearly within our power to change the cities we live in for the better. We can definitely do this, and we can do it on a dozen different levels. The question is, will we do this? I'm thinking of a quote I read the other day. Dan Rather said, maybe when all of this is over, we can widen the sidewalks. And I think it was an expression of the fact that we are now, more and more of us are walking, more and more of us are experiencing the public realm, 80% of which in our city is streets. We're experiencing the public realm in new ways. We're seeing things we never saw before. We're enjoying being able to walk places. We set up our lawn chairs on the curb and talk to our neighbors across the street at cocktail hour. It's a kind of, oh, gee, you know, this is a different way of living in the city. Could we make that something which we accommodate on an everyday basis? Of course we could. But disturbingly, there's not a lot of evidence that suggests that major pandemics, major health events like this, are transformative. Usually what people are always saying, I hear it every day, I heard it today during the governor's news conference, when we get back to normal, everyone said, when we get back to normal, and normal means driving my car to the mall, it means all of the stuff that's really we're not doing at the moment. The pollution levels have dropped. Seismologists are telling us that the earth has stopped vibrating because we're not moving around as much. I mean, you know, there's a lot of positive things that are happening. Will those get accommodated into the city of the future? Historically, the answer is no. So the challenge is ours to try and find a way to convert what we've experienced and what we know about what's been wrong.
All right, but hold on. I hear you. Historically, the answer is no. And you're probably not. If Howard Decker had a menu of 10 things you'd love to see accomplished, you probably can't get all 10. But maybe you get 2 or 3. I mean, realistically, I guess I understand the lesson of history you're bringing to us. But what do you think should be prioritized first, and how realistic are those things?
I think that the things we should be doing are all have to do with being more and more local, living more and more locally, having our food more and more locally sourced, being able to walk to get what we need, not having to get in the car all the time, really revaluing and thus redesigning our public realm so that it's more attractive, it's more beautiful, it's where we spend our lives, and it's the place that we love to be in. There's a little place out on Penfield Road. They set up a couple of tents, and they're selling things outdoors, and they're doing land office business because people can shop outside. Everything is local. The bread is baked locally. The vegetables come from local places. And everybody is commenting on how wonderful it is to be able to shop and enjoy a local place. And I think, basically, if our cities were clusters of neighborhoods that were focused on the local and the public realm was ours in each of our neighborhoods, that would be a gigantic step forward.
How possible do you see it?
It's completely possible. In fact, all the tools are there.
How likely?
Not very likely. Easy to do, simple. We know what to do. We could do it. How likely is it? Not very likely.
David Riley, what are the best changes we could make in our planning, in the way we structure our lives in cities and communities?
I think it would be great if we could recognize some of the strengths of living in a place like a city during a crisis like this, that there's infrastructure, there's access to services that are difficult to provide without a certain mass of population. Like Howard was talking about, living in a place where you can be able to walk to get things like groceries, even if you don't have a car, or even if transit is disrupted or service is reduced. I hope we don't lose sight of what a lot of the advantages and benefits are of urban living. So I guess I'm anxious that we understand really when we're through this what happened here and what density does and doesn't say about it. In terms of other things we could do, I think, thinking about the housing or about the crowding issue, I think should make us think about housing. We talk a lot about housing and needing more access to modern and healthy and uncrowded housing that's affordable to everyone. But I think that's something we need to make a greater priority going forward. I think we sometimes have a tendency to look at a bus go by and go, well, gosh, that bus is half empty. Why are they running that bus? And I would hope this makes us think about having enough frequency and capacity in public transportation systems that we can get people around without having to kind of jam them into to a subway car. Because, I do think that is perhaps a unique challenge of particularly kind of mega cities that have overtaxed public transportation systems, that we'll think about trying to build more capacity into those. Your topic coming up tomorrow, it sounds like, dealing with parks and green space, and how do you provide people access to the outdoors to be able to get out, to get some fresh air without, encouraging crowding or having people out playing basketball when really that's a hard way to maintain social distancing,
right.
But still giving people access to the outdoors, I think, is an important thing we'll have to think about more.
Evan, I think, Evan, that there's one other thing I would want to add.
Sure.
And that is that the virus has given us a chance to focus on who in our communities have suffered the most. And typically, the list is pretty short and pretty clear. It has to do with age. It has to do with underlying health. It has to do with poverty. And it has to do with climate. And one of the things that we're seeing is that older neighbors or neighbors who are in poorer health or neighbors who are poorer have suffered more. And if one could hope for anything out of all of this, one would hope that all of this has become much more conscious for all of us and that we would move to do something to help the poor, those who are not well, those who are older, in ways that we haven't previously. That would be the best outcome of all.
All right. Listeners, let's get some of your feedback here as we talk about the state of the pandemic and our future planning and our plans for cities and density and the way we live and the way we organize ourselves. Yes, tomorrow we are talking about parks And we'll certainly look forward to that conversation, because we've got a lot of listeners who have a lot to say about, you know, going to the park and feeling like runners aren't giving space, or bicyclists aren't giving space. People walking, are they giving space? Should they shut down this? Should they shut down that? They did in Rochester and a lot of places take the rims off basketball hoops publicly. And I know people weren't thrilled with that, but not everybody plays defense like City Councilman Mitch Gruber. Most people actually are much too close to you when you play basketball. I mean, you know, that's just not right now a safe activity. So we are going to talk about that tomorrow, but let's get some of your feedback now, and I will start with Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, one thing that really has been proven with this pandemic is the risk factor associated with mass transit. It's not just buses and trains, but it's also airplanes. There was no health screening whatsoever for people getting on a plane and flying from New York to California, or for flying from China to Los Angeles or whatnot. You could be sitting next to a person that harbors the virus, and you wouldn't know it until maybe you got it. If you look at the death rates for mass transit workers in New York City, MTA, I think it's like somewhere around 50, I think, subway operators as well as bus drivers that have already died from this. It seems like one of the best ways to stay safe is to stay away from mass transit. I mean, how do you fix this?
Okay. Robert, thank you. David Riley, you want to start? You brought up transportation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think avoiding mass transportation is an option for an awful lot of people. An awful lot of people rely on it, particularly in major cities. And I mean, even here in Rochester, there are thousands and thousands of people who rely on RTS to get around. So I think we need to think about ways to try to make it safer and to reduce crowding on transit. I think that means, like I talked a little bit about, trying to make sure there's capacity in the system for people to be able to catch a ride and not have to wait an hour for the next one and for it to be really unnecessarily packed. And I think you see some of that coming with Reimagine RTS, the redesign of the bus system, looking at having major transit routes have service every 15 minutes. I don't know that pandemic planning was a piece of that. I think that had more to do with keeping people being able to plan their lives around relying on being able to catch a bus without having to kind of memorize the bus schedule. But I do think that is something that can help as well. I do think that's a really good point, though, about airports. And I think sometimes kind of an overlooked conversation about why this has spread in some of our major cities, that you really have a tremendous movement of people through these airports. And I don't know that we've paid enough attention to that and thinking about how to minimize risks there. You know, I'm less attuned to airports, so I'm not sure exactly what the response should be there, but I do think it's something we need to think about carefully going forward.
Dr. Aline, when we think public health outside of a pandemic, how much should we be thinking about density, crowding, et cetera, how it impacts, you know, again, when we're not dealing with necessarily a virus with no vaccine?
Well, if I can go back to a couple of the other things
you
brought up about if it's possible to change things and the people in cities ever change. And if you go far back enough, things have changed radically after epidemics. I mean, there used to be epidemics of cholera all the time and other diseases like that, and there aren't anymore because cities all over the place built sewers and clean water lines into houses. And that was even before germ theory. So it is possible for us to get together and say, hey, you know, we don't want everybody dying, and we will do public health things for the whole population, and that will make life better for everybody. So I do think things can change even now. If you look around at what's happening in everybody's life, I mean, there are things that there was an article in the Times the other day, a doctor talking about he's lived through 10 years of change in 1 week. So when we want to, we can make change happen. So I wouldn't be quite as pessimistic as Howard.
Howard is always the sunniest pessimist. Dr. Aline, just a separate question, though, from a listener that I think you can address. Deb writes to say, another critical factor with COVID and other epidemics or health in general is poor access to health care in rural areas. It's harder to diagnose and care for people where care is limited, pandemic and otherwise. Dr. Aline?
Yeah, I mean, we have huge issues with medical care disparities in this country and in rural areas. We're closing hospitals and things like that in different parts of the country. And so that's always something to be thinking about, is how can everybody get access? But right now with COVID, people anywhere don't have access to testing and things like that. And we're having discussions like you've had on the show about how there aren't enough ventilators everywhere for everybody and things like that. So it's a broader issue even than the disparities in terms of pandemic preparedness. And it's more than medical care because, part of, we don't really know why crowding overlaps well with where all the cases are. Is it really how close you are to other people, or is it how easy it is for you to get to a sink with soap or for people on the bus to hand sanitizer? Because there are two really big key things together in the public health interventions that people have been doing that have been effective. There's the social distancing and the hygiene. Because if you touch surfaces and then touch your face, that's one of the big ways that the virus gets around to people. And so having those little bottles of hand sanitizer more readily available for everybody, again, we don't have proof right now that that's the difference, but that is something that's not that expensive, not that hard to do, and maybe that could make a big difference and get that to everybody.
Some more listeners. Go ahead, doctor. Yeah.
I was just going to say, in terms of like big picture, how do we prevent the next pandemic? Thinking about what we know from 1918 or what we know from the SARS epidemic not as long ago, where it seemed to start from the virus incubating in these civet cats that then got to people at the markets. The World Health Organization and other people have talked about doing something about that wildlife trade where animals are packed together in prolonged extreme overcrowding and very stressful situations for them. And that isn't something that's impossible to do. That's not a giant change in the world. And that maybe that would have a big impact on decreasing these kinds of epidemics. So there are things worth trying and investigating and looking into to see if they will work at a public health level and a prevention level.
All right, some more listener feedback. Earl in West Irondequoit says, I heard a reference to the change in the environment as a result of measures taken to fight COVID. This, to me, is the most important consideration. Major high-density cities such as Paris, Venice, L.A., etc., are seeing firsthand how much better things such as the air, noise levels, and etc. are. Environmental damage, climate change, and warming are far more of a threat than even a virulent virus. That's from Earl. Howard Decker, that tees you up there. Go ahead.
Well, and I really agree with Earl. I think that as wildly difficult as this virus is, as much suffering as it has caused, as problematic as it is for every citizen of the world, the environment is much more serious a problem. And the virus is like a dress rehearsal in some ways for what comes ahead, what lies ahead for all of us as the environmental issues become more and more problematic. So I think that one outcome we could hope for is that perhaps people will say, oh, I'm not sure about where my food is coming from. We need to be more resilient with respect to our food. Oh, I'm not exactly sure where my energy is going to come from because the virus has thrown some light on that. Maybe we should be more thoughtful about locally generated energy, for example. The environmental issues which lie ahead are way more difficult than the virus is for us at the moment, even as serious as this is. So I think Earl is exactly right to say to us, hey, We really need to see this as a call to action in order for us to start to really even more seriously tackle environmental issues.
David Riley, you want to respond to Earl as well? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point. I think one of the primary things that worries me about people taking away from the idea that density is dangerous is that it could hurt efforts to address climate change by shifting towards, you know, where appropriate, more dense living patterns, which are more efficient and require less car travel, and using that as a way to drive down emissions. And I hope what we take away from this in part, you know, in addition to what Howard talked about, is thinking about remote work and when travel is truly necessary, when can a business meeting really be done by video conference instead? How much can we really drive down emissions by changing the way we do business? So I really think it's important not to lose attention on the climate crisis.
All right, let me grab a phone call. Bonnie in Rochester. Hi, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Okay, here's my list. It's kind of a mixed up list, but here's the list, or at least part one. Free buses. Small, medium grocery stores that are located closer to the city. Well, they took all the ones out of Wegmans. That's been the transportation issue has been made harder because of that. There's been a movement in the last, I think, 10 years or so in Rochester to strengthen neighborhood groups, and they've done it mostly themselves with some, you know, support. And that's really an important piece when you're talking about all the local stuff that we'd like to see, because in my going to these meetings, many of the things that these groups talk about are right in that category. It's just that they don't have the power often, without making a big, big stink, they don't have the power often to make the changes. But if we made that part of government, a formal part of government, that those groups in the neighborhoods could make the choices, outright, that would help. Walkable sidewalks that don't, in the winter, don't make you fall. The question it raises about whether nursing homes, I don't know the full answer to this, whether the way we do isolate older people in nursing homes, even though we know some people need a lot of care, is the best model for us to use. And the other thing, which you've already started to talk about, is that we ought to be electing people that the first question we ask them, can you link together the issues we've seen at this virus outcome and climate change, and how you're going to deal with them together? They're not separate issues, and we need to have people who understand that and can take the risk and can be the leadership and not just talk about it.
Bonnie, thank you. David, are you seeing people able to link those things now?
Yeah, I think so, and I really hope that continues. And I think the link that people are making is more through the reduction of emissions, and I think that's sparking some thinking about how maybe we can change our lives looking forward. But I hope so. I guess I'm concerned about whether it lasts in the long term. Maybe I'm echoing some of Howard's cynicism there.
All right. Well, then, go ahead, Howard.
Well, the one thing that we should keep in mind is that the virus is not going to go away at a certain instant. And there won't be a moment when we say, oh, well, there's no virus anymore, so everything can go back to normal. Fortunately, in some ways, it will happen over a fairly extended period of time. Dr. Fauci says 12 to 18 months. If that's the case, and it takes us 12 to 18 months to see the virus really wrestled to the ground permanently, then we have enough time to do some of the things that Bonnie is talking about, to build more local access, to make it possible to walk more easily in all seasons, to make neighborhoods stronger and more viable centers of community activity. If, you know, we're going to have plenty of time to reflect on these things as this unfolds in front of us, and perhaps that should be some cause for hope and optimism, because the light that's gone on in many of our minds will stay on, and we'll begin to as the doctor has said, we'll begin to make some really positive changes.
All right, so 20 seconds apiece then, so you have to all be tight then. We've talked about the best case, the optimism. But, Howard, what would be the worst case? We don't learn what lesson?
Well, that we'll stop paying attention and go back to doing things we were doing before while the virus is still stalking the earth, and we'll be in really big trouble.
Okay.
So we really have to maintain the course here.
David Riley.
Worst case, I guess, driving further sprawl out of fear that density is really what drives us, which I think we've already seen is really not sustainable in terms of the climate, and I think carries its own inherent risks in a situation like this one with a pandemic.
Okay, Dr. Aline.
Well, just that we don't have to be afraid of density, but we should think about as much as we can improving living conditions for everybody to keep everybody healthy.
Are you confident we're going to do that?
Why not?
Yes.
That's exactly right. I think there's some inspiration coming from this hour because we absolutely can do all of these things. And I want to thank our guests for taking the time this hour. Dr. Andy Aline, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. Thanks for making the time, Doctor.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David Riley, a planner and senior research associate for the Center for Governmental Research. Always good, David. Thanks.
Same here, Evan. Thank you.
Howard Decker, architect and board member for the Community Design Center of Rochester. Sometime I'll get to see you and buy you a coffee, and we'll take a walk around Shalott or something, Howard.
I'd love that. Thanks, Evan. Talk to you again.
We will see it some point again in the future. Thanks, listeners. The whole team here at Connections. MRA Stein is the intern. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Wet, windy. So for more than ever, hope you're indoors this afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.